Okay. I had intended to bring with me a little condensed outline, but I couldn't get the printer to behave this morning, so I'll try to do that during the break. Any other housekeeping kinds of questions? Why don't we finish up with Chapter 1 and then spend a few moments kind of reviewing and addressing any unresolved issues before the exam on Monday. Then we'll move on to look at Chapter 2. Okay, I think we finished up yesterday with the cases having to do with remedies for a nuisance. Again, this distinction between the equitable remedies, allowing the judge to order the defendant to stop the offending behavior, as distinguished from a remedy which essentially compensates the plaintiff for the difference in value in the property resulting from the intrusion. And again, the defendant would prefer to have the right, so to speak, to force this exchange between the plaintiff and the defendant so that the defendant could make use of the plaintiff's property and only be forced to pay the difference in value. And obviously the owner of the property claims, as they did in both Boomer and in other kinds of cases, that this is something that goes with the territory of being a property owner. So the discussion in both cases sort of addresses this issue of injunctive and legal forms of relief. Now, there's another issue that didn't come up in Spur Industries that I wanted to review with you, since it's a source of potential confusion. There's a reference in Spur Industries about it being a public nuisance as well as a private nuisance. I'm trying to remember if there's any explanation of that anywhere, and I don't think there is. Okay. And the definition of the distinction, a public nuisance is something that is, as they say, always and everywhere bad. It is something that by itself is a bad thing. One of the areas that people are now using that as a point of leverage would be a place that's sort of a drug use magnet. So if, for example, you own a public park or an old abandoned building in an inner city that is used as a hangout for people who are using illegal drugs, this is identified as a public nuisance. And there's the statutory authorization for the law enforcement officials, the prosecutor, to take steps to remove this public nuisance. Whereas a private nuisance is, as they say, a pig in the parlor. It's something not by itself bad, but in the wrong place. So there is a place for feedlots, but not right next to residential developments. There's a place for industrial operations that make loud noises and generate noxious fumes and so forth and so on, but it's not next to residential areas. A private person can enforce a private nuisance by showing that there is an injury to that private person that amounts to an unreasonable interference with their an interference with their reasonable expectations. A public nuisance, by contrast, is remedied only by the public authorities. Now, as it happens in spur industries, they found it was both a public nuisance and a private nuisance. And I think I explained to somebody after class yesterday, it's one of the reasons why the court felt it had no choice about whether to call it a nuisance. Again, the whole coming to the nuisance argument has a bearing on whether something is a nuisance. If it's already in existence and the plaintiff sort of walks into it, you can say, well, this really doesn't interfere with your reasonable expectations. Again, because this was declared to be a public nuisance, and I don't exactly know how the public authorities were invoked here, but in finding that it's a public nuisance, the judge is in effect saying, gee, I can no longer say this is not a nuisance. Why it was a public nuisance, I'm not sure. It may have something to do with health, you know, with what feedlots generate in terms of, you know, breeding grounds for insects or what have you. But again, that I just wanted to clarify that point before we moved on. Okay, our last area today in Chapter 1 has to do with strict liability for animals. And we have this case from Wyoming. Mr. Mitchell, why don't you tell us about Williams? And for that purpose, it might just as well be that the dog bit him. The fact that he got injured by avoiding it rather than actually being bitten isn't the point of departure here. The plaintiff sues the defendant. What happens at trial? Okay. Why? Okay, and let's review for a moment the common law treatment of liability for an animal, for a dog bite in particular, or more generally, go ahead.
First bite.
Well, yeah, do we have this sort of proverb or expression, every dog gets one bite? It's actually misleading legally. May be useful in some other context, but it has the potential to be misleading. In fact, what is the common law rule? The striker? Correct. The rule is that you have to prove, you can always prove that the owner was negligent. If you succeed in proving that the owner was negligent in handling their dog or anything else, you're entitled to a recovery. But you don't have to prove negligence if, what's the trigger of strict liability? If the owner knows of the dog's dangerous propensities. Now, the knowledge of that dangerous propensity may arise as a result of the dog's first bite. But you could also know before the dog ever bites anybody, perhaps you've actually trained the dog to be ferocious. The law also distinguished between animals that were thought by nature to be relatively domestic, dogs being the chief example, or cattle for that matter, as distinguished from animals that by their nature were ferocious, like a tiger or a bear or a, you know, wolf or something. As to those animals that were ferocious by their nature, you didn't get the one bite rule. Because you already knew that these animals, by their nature, were likely to cause injury. If By contrast, a dog sort of got the benefit, or the owner of a dog got the benefit of assuming that the dog would be well behaved, and depending on the breed of dog, some dog breeds are more forgiving than others, and also by their training experience, again, some turn out to be easier to provoke than others. The point being, though, that in either the similarity is, once the owner is on notice of the dog's dangerous propensity, the owner becomes strictly liable. Okay. How? So the defendant says in this case, unless the owner, or unless the plaintiff established through some evidence that the owner was on notice of the dog's dangerous propensity, the rule of strict liability did not apply, and the plaintiff would have to prove that the owner was negligent. What's the plaintiff's reply to that claim? Well, she didn't have her hand raised. You know? Yeah, Mr. Lovac. I'm the only guy that gets to call on people. Mr. Lovac.
He tried to read it. Since the city has a statute that requires a dog restraint.
Okay, so the plaintiff responds by saying, well, maybe that was the rule of common law, but we have a statute that makes the owner liable on the first bite, the so-called leash law. Now, again, as a matter of public policy, you may decide to change the rules of the game. You could say that people who have toxic waste sites or people who have this or people who have that are now going to be subject to strict liability. There's nothing, shocking or irrational about having rules other than the ones that we sort of inherited from the common law. And the plaintiff says, indeed, Wyoming, this particular municipality, had chosen to create a leash law, making the owner strict. Now, you can imagine the benefits of such a law, in part because from the plaintiff's perspective, getting bitten by a dog, or in this case injured by the dog's dangerous behavior, it's hard for you to prove pre-existing knowledge. Unless the owner comes forward with, or you have access to information about the dog's previous behavior, how do you know whether this dog has bitten somebody before? And they may have bitten three or four people, but you can't prove that. Or it may also be the owner knew, had trained the dog to be dangerous, but unless you have some access to that information, it might be hard to prove. So again, the notion is you keep a dog at your peril. Okay, what's the defendant's response to the plaintiff's claim that this case is governed by a rule of strict liability? Yeah, again, it's a procedural problem. As we've seen before, you can get hung up not on the substance of your claim, but on the procedural niceties. And the procedural nicety in this case is that it was only by the time they got to the appeal stage that it dawned on the plaintiff that this was something they ought to be arguing. At the time the summary judgment motion was decided, the plaintiff hadn't come up with this strict liability theory yet, and so the court says it doesn't apply. Now, there's also some language in the opinion to the effect that this leash law might itself require some kind of knowledge. I think they say that where are we here? Yeah, the district court correctly concluded that Cheyenne's animal control ordinance, this is the very last paragraph on page 70, So his animal control ordinances did not provide appellant with presumptive proof that the Johnsons knew of the vicious nature of their dogs. Appellant was required to present as an issue the fact appellants had knowledge of the dangerous propensity of their dog. So again, there's some confusion about what the statute actually provided. But you could certainly have a statute. It's actually one of the things I want to emphasize could go beyond merely the issue of dogs here. I gave an exam one time that had a fact pattern based upon a real case in which some kids had gone to a convenience store and had purchased beer, and they were underage. They consumed the beer and then got into an automobile accident, injuring the plaintiff. The plaintiff sued the convenience store owner and utilized a statute that says anyone who sells alcohol to a person younger than 21 is liable for damages caused by consumption of that alcohol. If you were the plaintiff in that case, what legal theory would you use to try to recover? Statutory
violation.
Which would be?
Negligence per se.
If you're in a Cardozo jurisdiction, was it excused, whatever, blah, blah, blah. There's another way to skin that cat. If you're the plaintiff and you want to recover on the basis of that statute, the disadvantage of relying upon negligence per se is negligence is the issue. What could you argue as an alternative? This was the experience I had on the exam. But, to my surprise, Mr. Lynch? That the owner should be held strictly liable? On what authority? Mr. Ortiz? You could try to fit it into some other category, that it's a nuisance or that it's an abnormally dangerous activity, but you actually don't need to go that far. You could, Mr. Redmond?
Well, not because I was looking at the strict liability, and so if you want strict liability, then I'm not going to be able to help you out.
I do want strict liability.
Okay, well then, go someone else.
Okay. Mr. Glover.
Could you show that it's not a common usage and it's not appropriate for the area?
Why can't we simply say the legislature has so decreed? The language that probably washed over you without your recognizing it, but I said that the statute said anyone who sells alcohol to someone not of legal age shall be liable for the damages caused by the consumption of that alcohol. Well, it doesn't say they are it doesn't simply say thou shalt not sell alcohol to minors. The way it said thou shalt have a light on thy buggy at night, the statute said people who do this will be held liable. Now, that turned out to be a debatable issue. The trial court read that, and perhaps to give you some comfort here, the trial court didn't see it that way. The trial court saw this as a negligence per se statute, but the plaintiff appealed to the Supreme Court and said of that state and said, no, the statute is written in the form of creating strict liability. And all I have to show is that the defendant did what the statute declared would subject the people who sell alcohol do so at their peril. Now, again, I could try to fit it into carrying gasoline, you know, an abnormally dangerous activity run through the restatement criteria. I would have to do that if the legislature hadn't spoken. And I was simply trying to use some existing category of strict liability. But since legislatures have the ability to adjust tort liability as they see fit to impose it or remove it in the interest of public policy. The plaintiff in that alcohol case said this was an area where the legislature thought people who sell alcohol should do so at their peril. Now, well, yeah, Mr. Lobach. Well, the jury had, I can't remember whether it did make it to the jury. I think it may be that the trial court said this is a negligence per se case. And, in fact, when we talk about negligence per se, there are excuses. So the defendant said, my excuse is I didn't know of the occasion for compliance. Not an error of law. I'm not claiming I was unaware that I couldn't sell alcohol to minors. I claim I was unaware that this was a minor. You can imagine, for example, enterprising youths, they say in My Cousin Vinny, enterprising youths who go out and get, they're in their drama class and they make this guy up to look like he's, 45 years old. He walks in, puts a case of beer on the table and in his best gruff voice he can, pays for it. And the store owner doesn't have any reason to think this is a person whose ID he needs to check. Would that be an excuse to a statutory violation? I think that would go to the jury. And the jury might find that the behavior was excused. But it was the plaintiff's argument, which turned out to be successful in the end, that the legislature had set up this regime to say, in effect, when you choose not to card somebody, or when you choose to believe, I was in the store the other day, it was a Friday night. We were going someplace. My wife and I were going to somebody's house for dinner. We stopped at the Safeway on the way to pick up a bottle of wine to bring to the host. And as we're standing in line, the guy in front of us, presents this ID, and he said, the clerk at the store, she must have been, I don't even know if she, maybe not 21 and sell. Okay, so she's selling alcohol, selling it to us, thank God. But the guy in front of us, she looks at him, and he's got an ID, but she says, I go to school with your brother. This ain't going to work. And it was sort of like, don't put me through this. But whether you choose, the point being, if you want to go ahead and rely on the ID and you're prepared to take the chance that this is, but if it goes astray, the burden is on you, the alcohol seller, and if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. That may be good public policy and maybe bad public policy, but again, the point is that the legislature has the authority to decide these areas are going to be governed by a rule of reasonable care. So long as you use reasonable care, you can't be forced to pay compensation. But these other areas fall within a category where we think the defendant should bear the risk. And if things go badly, even though the defendant is not behaving negligently, the innocent plaintiff shouldn't be the one to bear the loss. The defendant who took the risk, who did so at his peril, now pays those consequences. So again, the whole issue here about the dog bite case, although it turns out the plaintiff failed procedurally, the general concept that legislatures can adjust these duties should alert you to the potential for that to be true in other areas as well. Mr. Galler?
So is it safe to say then that that's a fourth category of strict liability where there is a statute specifically?
Yeah, that's right. And one of these things I'm going to get around to sort of amending my my little chart there to reflect the fact. And what I think I might do is, yeah, I think I would have to, because while this case raises the issue about statutorily imposed strict liability, there is a separate category for animals, and there's a separate category for statutorily created strict liability. Yes? Questions? Mr. Bradford.
You brought up this procedural question, negligence per se. You brought up, they don't say it's excused and it's a matter of law.
Could be. That, again, that's jurisdictional. I think Mr. Loback's question was, if it's negligence per se, what's it doing going to the jury? And I'm imagining that even in a Cardozo jurisdiction that says jurors have no power to dispense the statutory requirements, jurors still have to consider excused violations. So I think in this case, there could either be a non-Cardozo Washington-type jurisdiction that says it's for the jury to decide the impact of a statutory violation, or even in a hardline Cardozo jurisdiction, it could be submitted to the jury on an excuse theory. And again, in a negligence per se case, negligence is the coin of the realm, whereas in strict liability, if you fit within a category that the cases or the statutes have declared to be subject to strict liability, negligence is no longer the touchstone of liability. Okay, let's just do a real quick review here of Chapter 1 before we move on to greener pastures. Look back at where we've been here. Chapter 1 deals with the question of when the defendant ought to pay for the plaintiff's injury. Now, there are other issues, obviously, beyond the question of breach of duty. There are questions about proximate cause and defenses and so forth. But primarily, as I said at the very outset, practically the first question you want to ask if you find out somebody's been in, let's say, an intersection collision, well, who was at fault? And while we've got a more sophisticated notion of liability than simply somebody being at fault, it's still not a bad kind of compass for us, because depending upon how we evaluate the situation, either the defendant deserves or doesn't deserve to pay for the plaintiff's injury. Now, the two methods that we've looked at are negligence and strict liability. We can make the defendant pay because the defendant was negligent, or we can make the defendant pay because we've decided as a society that what the defendant was engaged in at the time should be subject to a rule of strict liability. Let's take the negligence issue first. Negligence is the failure to use reasonable care. And as we define that, it may either be a sort of intuitive judgment, I wouldn't have done that, or I don't think a reasonable person would have done what the defendant did under those circumstances. Or in the alternative, we may have a more quantitative evaluation, sort of learned hand method of saying, I've looked at what the burden was to avoid this injury, I've looked at the probability of loss and the magnitude of a loss if an accident should occur, and it's my judgment that the burden was smaller than the product of those other two variables. Now, sometimes that quantitative methodology fits very nicely because we have data and because the activity is one where this sort of calculation is properly used. There may be other circumstances where it doesn't fit at all. And so again, you should spend a moment thinking about whether either of those methods more closely fits the facts and circumstances that would be to the advantage of either the plaintiff or the defendant to stress as the standard of what is reasonable care or the lack thereof. From there, yeah. Gina?
You don't necessarily have to have data or numbers to use.
No, you don't. And even in United States versus Carroll Towing, they didn't. But it's certainly not... But we're close to it. That is, it is the kind of thing where, again, in United States versus Carroll Towing, we could have put a number on the value of that cargo. And we could probably have come up with quantitative statistics. We could also calculate the burden. In other circumstances, like swatting a wasp or, you know, tying up your dog or other kinds of things, the whole notion of quantifying it just doesn't seem to apply. So again, it's the granddaddy of all these cases, United States versus Carroll Towing, doesn't actually use such a method. Doesn't actually use numbers, but it sort of fits. Okay, so having some standard in mind, we then look at more specific ways of proving negligence. Again, the first one is this idea of juror experience, that some activities you can simply put it to the jury. How does a reasonable person build a haystack or drive a car or mow a lawn or watch kids in the backyard? And again, sometimes that fits rather nicely, and oftentimes the jurors don't have experience with the particular thing that went wrong. Secondly, we might be very interested in knowing how the defendant's behavior compares to other people in a similar industry or activity. What do rock climbers as a group normally do? How do people go water skiing? In particular, how do industries manage, what procedures are there at an amusement park to prevent kids from being kidnapped? What are the procedures at a high school football game to make sure the players don't get injured? And knowing what the industry custom is will either be helpful to the defendant to say, gee, what I was doing is consistent with what other people do, or you may be able to point out some area where the defendant's conduct fell short of what is customarily done. That can be a strong support for the plaintiff's argument that the defendant was acting negligently. On the other hand, Learned Hand made it clear that as a legal matter, courts, and in particular juries, are not bound by the custom of the industry. They have the freedom to impose a standard of reasonable care, even if that comes as news to the people in that industry. Third area we looked at was statutory violations. Again, we talked about that a little bit earlier. Some jurisdictions use the approach that a violation of a statute designed for the purpose of preventing accidents like this, is negligence in itself, negligence per se. Other jurisdictions take the approach that a statutory violation is certainly evidence of negligence, but it's not negligence as a matter of law. The jury, in the end, must make their own evaluation of whether a reasonable person would have obeyed the law or might have gone a few miles an hour over the speed limit or what have you. Even in those jurisdictions that impose the more Cardozo-strict version, there is a place for excuses. So if the excuse is one that falls within one of those five categories mentioned by the restatement, where a person could reasonably choose to disobey the statute or might be disobeying the statute without knowing it because they don't realize the factual circumstances, so for those excuses, if they are objectively reasonable, go to a jury. Then we looked at res ipsa loquitur, the three elements of res ipsa loquitur. First, that it's the type of accident that leads us to conclude there was negligence because these kinds of accidents don't happen except when there has been negligence, generally speaking. Secondly, that the thing that caused the accident, the instrumentality is the term used, was in the exclusive control of the defendant. And finally, that we've excluded, sufficiently eliminated, other plausible explanations. It wasn't the plaintiff's fault, it wasn't some force of nature or some, you know, terrorist or some external force other than what we assume to be the defendant's negligence that caused the injury. Again, this only gets the case to the jury. The jury then decides whether on the facts they agree that the inference of negligence is justified. If not, they can find for the defendant. Fourth, we looked at... Fifth, we looked at the defendant's own safety policies, and the law distinguishes between post-accident repairs, inadmissible, except for certain unique circumstances where the defendant has raised an issue and the evidence of post-accident repairs is addressed to that issue, ownership or feasibility or some other way in which the defendant has raised an issue making this relevant. But it can't be used simply to show, well, after the fact, you acknowledge what you should have done before the fact. That's the purpose for which you cannot use post-accident repairs. By contrast, you can use those safety policies adopted by the defendant before the accident, what I call a rule book violation, not necessarily that it's written down as a physical rule book, but there are practices and procedures that the employer has established for conducting this activity, and you, by showing that the defendant's employee didn't abide by those, that's often a very powerful form of proving negligence. Mr. Ortiz. Oh, that we're getting there. The point that I'm on now is, to the extent that everybody agrees this person was an employee, the guy who's running the streetcar, and the plaintiff alleges they negligently failed to ring the gong, one way to prove that the failure to ring the gong was negligent is to show that the employer had a policy and procedure that the employee didn't follow. Again, the shorthand for that would be a rule book violation. Now, whether this person is properly categorized as an employee or an independent contractor is my next issue. So again, all of these five methods are a way of establishing what the defendant did was negligent. Glover.
Like on number three, when you show feasibility of the repair using the defendant's post-accident repair,
yeah,
does that not kind of in some way bring in their post-accident repairs as evidence against them?
Again, those first two exceptions to post-accident repairs, the inadmissibility of post-accident repairs, ownership and feasibility can only be the justification for introducing evidence of a post-accident repair if the defendant has disputed ownership or feasibility. So, again, it's the defendant's choice to put this in play, and similarly the last sort of catch-all exception, the defendant raised the issue on their own rather than the plaintiff anxiously, you know, trying to get it in. The plaintiff can't on their own bring it in. The defendant has to do something to invite it in, either by contesting ownership, by contesting feasibility, or by, you know, the manager saying, well, right after she fell, we brought the mats out and fixed it. Okay? So again, all of those different techniques, tools, will apply depending upon the facts and circumstances of the case. And again, one of your challenges on Monday will be how, as I read these fact patterns, do I pick, how do I learn to be a good connector here, recognizing this is a good place to invoke this doctrine, this is a place to talk about it but show why it doesn't apply, and this other doctrine I have kicking around in my head really doesn't belong anywhere in my discussion. Okay, now, if those are all different methods of proving negligence, the next issue goes to Mr. Ortiz's question, which is, how do I connect the behavior of the person who did the harm with somebody who's got a deep pocket? And in lots of cases, it's an obvious thing that the people, you know, when the lady slips and falls at Walmart, whoever negligently failed to put the mats out, these were Walmart employees. No one's even going to raise the issue about vicarious liability because it's so obvious. On the other hand, if you have someone whose relationship is less clear, where the defendant, the deep pocket, can claim, well, maybe that person did something wrong, but they weren't our employee, we're not vicariously liable for them, you have to evaluate the legal standard. And the legal standard is, does the defendant have the right, or did the defendant have the right to control what this person did? So, for example, I've got an exam out there someplace in which the accident happened when a flatbed truck collided with a guy on a motorcycle. And the flatbed truck was carrying some kind of hazardous cargo. I think it was uranium tailings or something from a mine or operation that generated uranium ore, processed it. So that was a nice little strict liability problem. But the other question that would arise in the case is whether the people who owned the ore could be held vicariously liable for what the guy transporting it did on the highway. Was he an employee of these people or was he an independent contractor? Again, the question legally is, does the defendant have the right to control how this person does their work? If they have the right to control, then that person is legally deemed to be an employee, regardless of how they get paid. Even if they get paid a flat fee, $300 for every load that you transport from here to there, $15 for mowing my lawn. Or if they're paid by the hour, I pay my plumber so much per hour to repair the stuff in my basement, but he's an independent contractor because I don't have the right to control the way he does his work. Even once a person is in, you've determined they're an employee, you have to figure out, did the accident occur in the course and scope of employment? Part of that is, are they on the job? And obviously when I'm here teaching my class, I am on the job. What happens if I go out to get a sandwich at lunch and I get into an auto accident? Could somebody sue Gonzaga University for my negligence? No, because I'm not in the course and scope of my employment for Gonzaga University when I go out to lunch. On the other hand, what happens if I'm driving downtown to go to an alumni reception? I want to go there and greet my former students and make them want to donate money to the law school. Am I driving from here to there in the course and scope of my employment? What happens if I go to CompUSA to see if I can find a printer toner cartridge? But then I'm going later on to the alumni reception. I get into an accident. Again, when am I in the course and scope of my employment, I could state a set of facts that would lie just somewhere in the middle. Well, maybe I was on the way, maybe I wasn't. But at least that's the question you would ask. If he's in the course and scope of employment, then Gonzaga University is vicariously liable. On the other hand, if he's on his own, they're not. There's an additional question, not just, you know, what was I on the job, but even while I'm on the job, what actions can I take that lie within or lie outside of my employment? If I and my colleague get into a heated argument over Supreme Court nominees, and it degenerates to the point where we're we have a fist fight up on the fourth floor, and I punch him in the nose, or more likely he punches me in the nose, is Gonzaga University vicariously liable for those actions? The answer would be no, because that's not in the course and scope of my employment or my colleagues. If, on the other hand, I'm here late at night, somebody comes into the law school, I don't think they belong here, I question them, they get irritated that I'm not being particularly nice to them, that degenerates and I physically throw them out of the law school building, would that be in the course and scope of my employment? Probably so. Again, you at least want to, if you looked at a fact pattern and you said to yourself, oh, this is obvious, of course this person is or this person isn't. On the other hand, if you look at it and say, gee, this is kind of a tough question, I'm not sure, I'm inclined to think this person would be in the course and scope of employment, but maybe not. Maybe you can make an argument that they're really not in the course and scope. Again, raise that issue. Of all things on exams that you want to do, it's better to sort of think broadly. Certainly offer to me as you would offer to your client. My hunch is it would tend to go in this direction, but frankly, I'm not here to tell you for sure what it's going to be. And this goes to a larger piece sort of exam advice, perhaps advice about life in general, that the most important thing is not, as they say, what gets you into trouble is not what you don't know, but it's the stuff you think you know but isn't so. Your greatest challenge on the exam is to figure out what do I know, and I can state it clearly and forthrightly, and what are the things that I don't know? What you don't know may be a result of something nobody knows. For example, exactly how this particular case would be resolved, how this fact pattern would be evaluated under some legal standard. It may be you are ignorant of the outcome because you don't know what jurisdiction you're in. The rule is clear in this jurisdiction, but they follow just the opposite rule in another jurisdiction, and on the exam you don't know what jurisdiction you're in. You may be ignorant of something because, quite frankly, you were a little bit weak. You never quite got that part of the course. It's still a little hazy in your mind. Now, you have no embarrassment about confessing your ignorance with respect to items 1 and 2 because no matter how good a lawyer you are, you don't know necessarily what rule the jurisdiction is going to follow if you don't know what jurisdiction you're in. And you don't know the answer to cutting-edge cases where courts go back and forth on it. So you wouldn't have any shame about acknowledging that, but you would have shame and therefore are inclined to cover up the fact that you're really still confused about the difference between negligence per se and res ipsa loquitur. Now, I'm not encouraging you to be ignorant about those things by any stretch of the imagination. The more in the time allotted to you, you can learn these things and get them down cold, the better. But job one is kind of keeping track and being brutally honest with yourself and honest at least to the extent with your client that you don't claim things to be true that you know yourself are not true. Well, I know this when you really don't know it. And I think students often get into trouble because they feel my job is to put up a good front here, to at least have the confidence to declare things boldly, even if I harbor doubts about whether I've got this right. And that's a quick way to wind up in a place you don't want to be, namely misstating something. And I have no way, as I read an exam, of distinguishing somebody who's putting up a brave front, who secretly doesn't have much certitude about some proposition, but is pretending to have that certitude in the hopes that they'll be lucky enough to be right. And they certainly don't want to admit that they're really unsure about this particular point. It may be that the student in real life would scurry to the books and go, check it up. I think this is what it is, but I'm not really sure. Let me go check this out. But if you say something positively on an exam, I have no way of knowing that secretly you're in doubt about that and would go look it up. If you're in doubt about something, say so. I guess what is long, or the short way to say that very long thing. But again, it's a sort of deeper problem that none of us likes to say, oh, gee, I really don't have the answer to that. I think it's this, but I'm not really sure. Oftentimes, we feel that level of ignorance is culpable, that we should be sure about it, and we figure better to sound sure. First of all, I might happen to be right. And secondly, even if I'm wrong, there's a pretty good chance the person to whom I give this answer with certitude won't find out about it, and I won't suffer any penalty for it. And if I do so, it'll be long down the road. Better to just kind of... I really want to discourage you from having that mindset. On the exam, you're far better off to say, let me kind of think through this here. On the other hand, again, there are certain things that you should know and know that you know. Negligence is the failure to use reasonable care. That you can say with some confidence rather than, well, I'm not really sure about this, but I think negligence is something like, you know, if you can't be sure of anything, you'll never make it through the exam just, you know, time-wise. So, again, having some areas of confidence and of certitude contrasted with those areas where you say, gee, this one's still kind of up in the air. You'll often find yourself in very good company by saying, I really can't say for sure whether this person was acting in the course and scope of employment. What I can tell you is that when an employee acts negligently in the course and scope of employment, the employer is held vicariously liable. How that principle applies in this case, gee, it's debatable. My guess is that these attributes, these facts would lead somebody to conclude that he was or he wasn't in the course and scope of employment, but it seems like a debatable question. That's a great answer. That's the A in the IRAC, issue, rule, application, conclusion. Sometimes the application is clear, this element is missing, conclusion, doctrine doesn't apply. But oftentimes, and sometimes, you know, all three elements are met, conclusion, rule applies. But oftentimes what you say is, items, you know, elements one and three are clear, but two is debatable, that's my application, my conclusion is, toss up. Res ipsa might apply, it might not. And again, as you go through looking at those sample answers, you'll see this methodology at work. Clear statements of the rule, oftentimes application that recognizes subtlety in the fact pattern, conclusions that are ambivalent. Okay, questions about, that was all negligent vicarious liability. Good. 3 minutes on strict liability. Strict liability applies in pockets. Abnormally dangerous activities. We looked at the criteria under the restatement. They're criteria, not elements. They don't all have to be met. We simply apply the criteria and make a judgment about the court, I should say. The judge makes a a determination of whether this activity ought to be judged by a rule of strict liability or subject to a rule of ordinary negligence. Secondly, the idea of nuisance, that the defendant's activity invaded the plaintiff's reasonable expectations. Again, the plaintiff's reasonable expectations being judged by kind of sort of common sense or in some cases zoning rules as to what's appropriate in the area, what's not. The timing of, you know, how the character of the neighborhood was established, whether the plaintiff came to the nuisance and so forth. But if the plaintiff indeed had a reasonable expectation to be free of this invasion, the defendant's invading the plaintiff's property can be held to strict liability. Then finally, this whole idea of animals, the liability either for animals ferocious by nature, like a lion or a tiger or a bear. By contrast, domestic animals don't subject the owner to strict liability until the owner is on notice of the animals being ferocious. And then finally, the idea that the legislature, by statute, could change the rules and subject things to strict liability, which it believes as a matter of public policy are appropriate, and by contrast, it could remove strict liability if it wanted to from some category that the common law had previously treated in that way. Questions before we take a quick break? Ms. Bradford.
Other animals and dogs, do you consider certain breeds, they comply, they have a dangerous
tendency? That's a good, you know, make a good exam question. The owner buys a dog, let's say, what are these?
Pitbull,
yeah. Owner buys a pit bull, believes that pit bulls can be redeemed. They've gotten a bad rap, you know. Or takes it in as an little orphan pit bull, you know. In fact, early in our marriage, my wife and I had a Doberman Pinscher that we were taking care of, who used to jump up on the bed and snuggle with us. I have it in my mind, I want this dog to overcome the stereotype that they're mean and ferocious and they're really cuddly, you know, they're just misunderstood. Dog's never bitten anybody, but I know it's a pit bull or I know it's a Doberman Pinscher. Am I unnoticed because of the dog's breed, or do I get one free bite? That would be a great exam question where you would evaluate, again, rule, owner's not liable unless owner knows of dog's dangerous propensity. Does the breed itself carry with it the notice of this dangerous propensity, or does a pit bull, like a, you know, border collie, benefit from the presumption, does the owner benefit from the presumption that until you actually, you know, is the adage closer to the mark, that the dog gets one free bite? That so long as I have not seen this dog live up to the stereotype, I'm okay. Mr. Cleveland?
These gray areas with the breed of the dog and so forth, are they decided by the judge or by the jury?
I think the question of strict liability would be decided by the judge. Now, I mean, just to be difficult on that point, you might have dispute. So, for example, the judge might have to hear, and the judge might even turn over to the jury the evaluation. The clearest, I would say, with respect to the knowledge point, suppose the plaintiff has a neighbor who says, I saw that dog snap at people. That owner knew this dog was dangerous. The owner, by contrast, denies it, says, the neighbor is a busybody who hated me for more, you know, I was lying. Okay, I've got this classic factual dispute that juries are normally expected to resolve. The judge might say to the jury, I want you to decide whether the owner, based on this conflicting testimony, did or did not know of the dog's dangerous propensity. You come back with a verdict on that point. From there, I'll take it and apply strict liability. So, again, you might have this sort of mixed question of fact, what did the owner know and when did he know it, and the question of law, does strict liability apply, where the facts are undisputed, the application of law on strict liability would be for the judge, but where the facts are disputed in a typical kind of cross-examination, demeanor, lying, etc., the judge might say, hey, you know, that's what juries do. I think if it's the application of strict liability, my guess is that that would be for the judge. Hear me talk here. My guess, again, I since you're not grading me, I get to do that. But I kind of want you to get the confidence at this point. The words may kind of stick in your throat. Gee, I'm guessing. I don't know. Your impulse, a healthy impulse, is to sort of move from the gee, I'm just civilian here to being I'm the lawyer, and hear, O Israel, and part of that's a healthy impulse, but. But the ironic thing is that when you get to the other end, the very experienced lawyers, they begin to sound like, in the Watergate era, what was his name? The chief counsel for, or the senator from North Carolina, I think, I'm just a country lawyer. A sort of folksy manner, but again, the idea that your first line of defense is to say, I'm still kind of struggling with this one, rather than being prematurely forced into declaring yourself because you feel I have to have an answer to this. Also, it may be sort of the multiple choice notion. If you put a little question mark between B and C, that doesn't do you any good. You're better off to circle either B or C, even though you're really kind of, it's a toss-up. Whereas in this environment, guessing at things is more likely to get you into trouble unless you clearly identify it. I'm unsure of this. My guess is such and so. That can often be a good... I'm impressed that you're guessing in the right direction because you can easily go verify it. My guess is this would be a question for the judge, although some issues might be submitted to a jury for their evaluation. I can go track that down and get you more specific authority. So, Gallup.
Are you looking to see an exhaustive consideration and elimination type of process?
Well, I've come up with a formula on this. You go to the doctor, and the doctor evaluates some condition that you have. I've got this kind of, discomfort in my abdomen. And the doctor says, well, to be honest with you, I think it's just indigestion. But it could be cancer, it could be this, it could be that. Now, cancer is very unlikely, very probably indigestion, but the fact that the doctor is kind of thinking globally before he acts locally is a good feature of the doctor. I appreciate that fact. And particularly if there's a quick way to exclude it. I'll just run this little test and we can rule out whether you have cancer or not, or heart disease or some other thing that could kill me. Even if it's a remote possibility, but something that could kill me, I want him to think about that. By contrast, it doesn't do me or the doctor any good for him to say, gee, I wonder if you're pregnant. Speaking to me, if I didn't have a Y chromosome, that would be a more but so there are some things where if the doctor said, now your symptoms could be, you know, I mean, it might be a little interesting bit of medical lore here, that, and I am impressed that if I were a woman, you know, he would have all these interesting ways of, well, it could be this and it could be that. But in those, in that particular circumstance, the evaluation of whether my symptoms are a result of my being pregnant is of absolutely no use. Now, applying that standard as you run through, for purposes of this exam, you can get away with basically making a list of all the issues that we've covered and just kind of mechanically checking them off. This applies, this doesn't, this applies, this doesn't, with a brief explanation why. There's no nuisance here because there's no property rights involved. Bingo. Next issue. On the midterm exam, that is the one 2 weeks from Monday. It's 11 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? For that exam, you simply can't afford to go through everything in that mechanical way. It's probably physically possible, but you have to have a way of just sort of filtering in and filtering out. You're probably going to make some mistakes. You're probably going to throw stuff in that really didn't belong. You're probably going to leave something out I thought was worth mentioning, even to the point of mentioning it and excluding it. You don't have sickle cell anemia because that's a characteristic of some racial groups. You don't belong to that racial group. Again, you know, there may be something that's worth doing, not worth doing. I don't know. Does this help your medical evaluation? But again, if in the back of your mind your criterion is, I want to help my client. I want to give my client as much information and the most important information because they are the ones that have to make the decision. They have to decide whether to pay me a bunch of money to go chase this claim down, whether to expect something from this case, or basically to write it off as a not going anywhere. As a defendant, they have to decide whether to get prepared to offer some decent money in settlement, whether they could expect to hang tight and see this through and beat this case. So to make that decision on which their business or their kids' college education may depend, I want to give them the best information I can, even at this early date. And if that is in the back of your mind, rather than how do I make myself look smart? Again, if the doctor's telling me, well, gee, the symptoms that you have actually are related to a hormone change that happens when a woman's... Well, yeah, doctor, I'm real impressed with what a smart doctor you are, but it doesn't help me decide what I want to do with my healthcare. So if you're moving in that direction of helping your client, I think you'll naturally filter in the things, gee, this could help, as distinguished from, well, that's not going to help my client. I can sure impress Professor DeWolf with how well I learned this area of the law, but that's not the name of the game here. It's not what he's looking for. Other questions we need to take a Ms. Reed.
I've got a question that I want to clarify on the dog leash law.
Yeah.
I'm not clear on why that wouldn't be a statutory law.
It could be in this case that if this guy had pled it properly in a timely way, he would have had a fine time. But he just waited too long for that to show up on his radar screen. By the time it occurred to him, the process had already passed him by. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and start Chapter 2.